Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unexpectedly decisive ruling from the Supreme Court of 6-3 to uphold federal subsidies on federally created insurance exchanges, thus saving so-called Obamacare and President Obama's place in history. We'll begin with Wendell Potter, a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity and a former chief corporate spokesman at Cigna and head of communications at Humana, Inc. His new book is Obamacare, What's in It for Me? What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act. And we will discuss this victory for the president, who at the White House today said, after nearly a century of talk, we finally declared that in America, healthcare is not a privilege for a few, but a right for all. The Affordable Care Act is here to stay. Then we look into the politics behind the long struggle to get health care reform, with the Affordable Care Act now having survived a second near-death experience, overcoming its last major hurdle. Jonathan Cohn, a senior national correspondent at the Huffington Post and author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price, joins us to discuss whether the Republicans will still campaign against Obamacare. Then we will speak with Ian Millhiser, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of Injustices, The Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. We'll give the Supreme Court credit where credit is due and analyze why they took the case and why they ruled so clearly in Obama's favor. Then finally, we'll examine the role of Wall Street in our increasingly dynastic politics and look into the ties that the Bush family dynasty have to Wall Street as the big bankers fall over themselves to throw money at Jeb Bush's presidential campaign. Nomi Prince, an author and senior fellow at Demos, who was a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group for Bear Stearns, joins us to discuss her latest book, All the President's Bankers: The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. And joining us now is Wendell Potter, the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. After a long career in the for-profit health industry as a chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc., he is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. His new book is Obamacare, What's in It for Me? What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendell Potter.
Thank you, Ian.
And were you surprised today by this very decisive ruling?
I was relieved. I can't say I was really surprised. I was expecting and hoping, of course, that the Supreme Court would uphold the subsidies, and obviously they did that. But I felt that Chief Justice Roberts in particular would probably be the more pragmatic of the conservative justices and realize that a ruling for the plaintiffs would create chaos in the insurance marketplace. And that was reflected in the first paragraph of his decision. He noted that. So he really came down on the side of the law for the government, as I had thought he probably would.
So just to go back to the beginning of this long saga, and it has been a long saga, and the Republicans have tried to repeal it 58 times or something, it survived a couple of near-death experiences, some of them self-inflicted wounds, like the rollout of Obamacare online, which was a catastrophe. But the first Supreme Court ruling, of course, was a nail-biter, and this second one was much more decisive. But to go back to the beginning, single payer, which is the system that most of the other advanced industrial states use, was never on the table, right? So this was always, Obamacare was always something that was a buy-in for big pharma, big healthcare, and big insurance, right?
That's exactly right, Ian. In the current environment, the current structure of American politics, it's about all we could do because those entities, those special interests are so powerful. They spend so much money influencing public opinion, influencing elections, lobbying, that there was no chance that in this kind of environment that the single-payer advocates really could advance the ball very much. I don't think that it's out of the question that someday we will have a single-payer system. I think, quite frankly, it's inevitable. But it's going to be some time, and to circle back to answer your question more succinctly, yes, we got what we could get considering the power of the special interest.
But what seems to me pretty remarkable about Obamacare, its real achievement is that it's actually given insurance, health insurance, to the poorest among us, who about 10 million of whom have never had insurance before. Now, the price that we've paid has been, I think, that everybody else is finding their premiums are not lowered. They've gone up, if anything. And the logic of it, of course, in all insurance pools is the more people that buy in or join the pool, at the end of the day, costs will come down. So where are we on that trajectory?
Well, reality is, you're correct. A lot of people are able to get coverage that is affordable to them, primarily because of the subsidies that were upheld today. If it weren't for those subsidies, then we would have not made much progress at all in bringing more people into coverage. The reality is that health insurance companies just simply cannot control healthcare costs. And something that I think more and more business leaders are going to be waking up to realize in the years to come. It just is not a very efficient way to finance healthcare, and we've tried it for many years. The Affordable Care Act is giving the insurance companies a few more years, but I think over these next few years, it's going to become abundantly clear that they're not essential. Why do we have them? When you realize that premiums are going to continue to go up for most people, and they're going up because most of these companies have to make a profit, the insurance companies do, and they are not able to control costs. They're not able to negotiate very good deals with big hospitals anymore, for example.
Well, but that's always been the logic of single payer, is that there's, at the end of the day, you don't really need insurance companies. They're an unnecessary layer between the patient and the caregiver.
Right, exactly right. And I think more and more people are going to be coming around to understanding the wisdom of that. But like we said before, at the juncture that we were at, where we were in history in 2010, it just wasn't possible. I do think that if we can do something about how big money controls politics, that single payer will have much of a better chance. On the other hand, even without that, I do think you're going to see corporate leaders in this country begin to speak up and say, this doesn't make any sense. We as businesses are continuing to pay a lot of money. A lot of our money is going to insurance companies, and they're not bringing costs down. They're not doing what they say they can do. So I think you're going to start seeing change as a consequence of changing attitudes among business leaders in this country.
And again, I'm speaking with Wendell Potter, who's the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. After a long career in the for-profit health industry, as a chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana Inc., he is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity, and his new book is Obamacare, What's in It for Me? What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act. Now, this the cost issue and the fact that insurance companies can't get their hands around rising costs, and we know that we are up to about, 18% of GDP for healthcare costs when the rest of the world or the advanced industrial world is around 6 or 7%. So it is out of control, and it grows all the time. I mean, the Republicans are absolutely bankrupt, though. I don't know whether you saw the 60 Minutes piece the other night on the cost of cancer drugs now, cancer drugs that are saving people's lives are also bankrupting them, taking away their inheritance and impoverishing their children because it costs like $100,000 a year. Why does it cost this money? Because the Republican Congress passed a law forbidding the government to bid on or to get deals on drugs, that they simply have to pay the government and the taxpayer has to pay for these drugs at whatever the price is that the big pharma decides. And they can write their own ticket, and they have been doing it. It's an absolute obscenity.
It absolutely is. And not only that, I mean, that is as absurd as it could possibly get. When people, and I am writing a new book, and I have a chapter about that exact how that happened, how that came about. But not only can the government not negotiate for lower drug prices, again, the insurance companies pretty much have to pay what drug companies say. Insurance companies are not as powerful as we've been led to believe. They simply cannot control drug cost or hospital cost. And that's going to become increasingly evident. I think we're going to start seeing a big backlash against drug prices. I think the industry is going far beyond what they should be doing, and that's going to result in a backlash. And that's going to get the attention of business leaders who are going to say, this just doesn't make, this makes no sense.
But how does Kaiser do it and manage its costs? It seems to be a very functioning organization, and it goes back to World War II, doesn't it?
It does. But there again, Kaiser isn't able to control drug costs very much. I spoke at a Kaiser hospital in California not long ago, and I was told that they're now paying more for drugs than they are for the salaries of the doctors who work for them. Kaiser is different because their model is what is referred to as an integrated healthcare delivery system. They own their own hospitals. They employ their own doctors and staff. And so they don't have the need to have a profit margin on their insurance side of the business as insurance companies do. So they don't have the corporate overhead that has to be fed as you do in the rest of the healthcare system. So that's one of the reasons. And because it's an integrated system, care is better coordinated between, for example, primary care doctors and specialists. So people, in a sense, are getting much better care. And it's been proven in that kind of a system than you get in the rest of the healthcare system.
So there's no way that all the insurance companies can get together. I mean, what does this require? As we said earlier, the Republicans in Congress under George W. Bush deliberately passed a law that prevented the government from negotiating prices down in bulk buying since, you know, the government's the biggest buyer of all. So Medicare has just become a huge slush fund, a trough for everybody to soak, you know, to rip it off. And it's crazy and unsupportable. But, you know, this is the party that's supposed to be the party of big business and you know, rational business behavior, when in fact they just, you know, they obviously allowed the big pharma to write the laws and they just dutifully pass them as the lobbyist handed them to them. I mean, it's pretty obscene.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. But it wasn't just Republicans. There were a lot of Democrats who were complicit as well.
Well, they're all on the take from big money. That's our political system. But what can be done to correct it?
What can be done is changing the way do something about the way big money controls their system. And if you don't begin to address that, you might as well just give it up because we're not going to get the other changes we need. Pharma will continue to have its way with lawmakers because lawmakers are dependent on the money that they give in campaign donations. And if they don't, and here's an example. Some of the most liberal senators, Al Franken and Elizabeth Warren, were liberal icons, both supported legislation to roll back the excise tax on medical devices, which is part of the Affordable Care Act to help pay for expansion. They did that because their home states of Minnesota and Massachusetts, they're medical device manufacturers in those states. They make campaign contributions, and if Franken and Warren don't go along with what they want them to do, then they'll give that money to an opponent. That's the way it is. And until we do something about that, even the Al Frankens and the Elizabeth Warrens are going to be beholden to big money.
So this is beyond political leadership then, because the political system itself is corrupt. Is that's what you're saying?
It's exactly what I'm saying. It's very corrupt. We have a system that is hardly a democracy anymore. It is it is run by and for the big special interests, and in fact, the big corporations, like the ones I used to work for.
Right, but the other big corporations that are being gouged, and she says, you know, it's becoming the biggest item on their payroll is their health and pension outlays for their employees. Can they all get together and say enough already?
Yes, they can, and I think they will. Now, it may take someone helping to coalesce that group, but I do think we will see at some point in the not-too-distant future some leading CEO, and maybe with one of the more enlightened companies or the newer companies like a Google or a Facebook or some company that wasn't even around 20 years ago to take a look at where we are and say, this just doesn't make any sense. Those are the people who have been in the business of disrupting the way things have been. And I think you'll see that they will begin to look at our healthcare system and realize this needs to be disrupted, and I'm going to do something to do the disrupting.
Well, Wendell Potter, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who's the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. After a long career in the for-profit health industry as a chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc., he is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. His new book is Obamacare, What's in It for Me? What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether or not the Republicans will continue to wage war against Obamacare.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. So no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jonathan Cohn, who's a senior national correspondent at the Huffington Post, who was formerly a senior editor at the New Republic and an executive editor at the American Prospect. He's the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Cohn.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And clearly, at least 6 or 7 million people are not going to pay the price if the Affordable Care Act were to be struck down by the Supreme Court, which it wasn't. A 6-3 decision in the opposite direction was something of a surprise. Were you surprised?
Yes. I mean, people had asked me all along, how will the Supreme Court rule? And I said, I'm not going to make a prediction because I don't know. So in that sense, I think any decision would have been surprising. It was very difficult to tell, for sure. That said, if you asked me the sort of more likely and less likely, I had assumed, a lot of us, I think, assumed it would be a close 5-4 decision, that it would be one of the conservatives joining the four liberals and making an argument that appealed that it somehow advanced the conservative agenda in some clear way, even as it allowed the law to stand. That was sort of the best case scenario, which was similar to what happened in 2012, the last time there was a case like this about the healthcare law. And I don't think anybody, and I would say no one expected, but it seemed unlikely, a little far-fetched, that number one, it would be 6-3, so that you'd have both of the sort of swing conservative votes, Justice Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts joining the Democrats. And then number two, it would be a short, direct, simple opinion, not going to some, you know, there were all these sort of legal gymnastics they could have used to justify it. And they basically just came out and said, look, we think this is actually a pretty straightforward case. And, you know, the law means something pretty simple, and the people who are challenging it aren't reading it the right way. And that's it. You know, and I think that was in some ways more surprising even than the tally, just it was such a simple decision, which very consistent with what the government had argued. But, you know, by the time it got to the Supreme Court and then we spent the weeks and weeks waiting for a decision and everyone was writing feverishly about it, I think a lot of us, you know, sort of lost sight of that, that this could just be a very simple decision.
Well, there was a certain simple elegance to Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice's majority opinion. Congress passed the Affordable Care Act to improve health insurance markets, not destroy them. If at all possible, we must interpret the act in the way that is consistent with the former and avoids the latter. That seems to be a monument to common sense.
It really is. I mean, it's so simple that, it, you know, it makes you wonder, what have we been, you know, how did this case get this far and why, how have we spent so much time arguing about it? I mean, and it's been a long argument, right? I mean, it's been, I alone, you know, I'm like a lot of reporters who cover this. I don't know how many hours I've spent in the last several years, but particularly the last 6 months, you know, pouring into this and having these extended arguments about, you know, the meaning of this word versus that word and what so-and-so was thinking at the time and dredging up this bit of historical evidence about the intentions of Congress. And, yeah, no, it was just a very elegant, simple statement. Hey, the law was obviously designed to help people get health care, and this is how it works. And so whatever, this one part of the law doesn't read in a clear way and fine, but everything else does. What's the issue here?
Well, clearly this did not satisfy Justice Antonin Scalia, who wrote the dissent, joined by Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. When Justice Roberts announced the majority opinion, he then turned to Scalia for the dissent, and it was like a tiger coming out of a cage. Scalia just absolutely eviscerated the majority opinion, complaining about interpretive jiggery-pokery, arguing that the court's job was not to make up for the sloppy drafting of the law by Congress, which I guess, in a way, really does raise a question of, was this some weird kind of vindictive case here? Just because of a typo, a badly structured sentence, you should really go after them? Is that the judiciary's role, to be the fact checker for Congress?
Well, you know, look, I mean, I think if you asked John Roberts, he would not say that, you know, they were doing jiggery, whatever the phrase was, that I can never get it right. You have to give Justice Scalia credit. He is a good writer, and, you know, he comes up with these good phrases. It's not the Supreme Court's job to fix problems that Congress created, but if you read the decision that Roberts wrote, he's not saying that we should fix Congress. He's saying, you know, they made pretty clear what they wanted to do, and we're interpreting that. And you know, something that needs to be remembered, writing a law is a complex process. Writing a complex law is an immensely complex process. When you write something this big, so complicated, inevitably there are going to be places where the law is written and you look at it afterwards and say, oh, wait, this section refers to that section, which doesn't exist anymore. And this happens all the time. It was probably a little worse in this law because of how it ended up passing. But, I mean, this thing happens all the time. It's not unusual. And usually what happens afterwards is the Congress passes what's called a bill with technical fixes. And they say, hey, obviously we meant to do X. The law doesn't make that clear, so let's specify that. And, you know, in an era when the parties can work together, that's done as a matter of routine. It's understood to be part of governing responsibly. Once a law passes, you try to make it, you know, you sort of in good faith, you know, try to make it, you know, work within its own definition. I mean, if you don't like it, you can try to repeal it or modify it by other legislation. But in general, it should work the way it was intended to work. You know, that didn't happen with this time. There's been a sort of scorched earth strategy to destroy the law from day one by any means possible. I think people need to remember this particular case, if you sort of trace the history of it, a key moment very early on is this conference by a number of conservatives who don't like the law. And at this conference, you know, and this is where the sort of idea is first floated of this lawsuit, and people start to say, wow, this could go somewhere. And one of the speakers there basically got up and said, we need to strangle this law in the crib. We need to, I mean, very vivid language, you know, making no, not trying to hide the sort of motive here. And it was basically, by any means necessary, take down this law. And that's what this lawsuit was about.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Cohn, who's a senior national correspondent at the Huffington Post. He was formerly a senior editor at the New Republic and an executive editor at the American Prospect. And he's the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. So far, Senator Marco Rubio, running for president in the rather crowded Republican field, has come out saying that I disagree with the court's ruling and believe they have once again erred in trying to correct the mistakes made by President Obama and Congress in forcing Obamacare on the American people. I guess, is that sour grapes, do you think?
Well, you know, I think they're upset that they lost. And, you know, the interesting question to me is this. Republicans will continue to campaign on this, particularly with there's a Republican primary race going on right now. And this is, for conservative voters, this is such an important issue. I mean, for a lot of them, and the polling bears this out if you really dig into it, you know, it's not just about the health care law, right? It's also about deeper feelings they have about Obama and the Obama presidency. And it's the Affordable Care Act as a symbol of all that. So this is not something they're going to want to let go of. And look, we all have those issues in America, right? You know, everybody's got their, you know, things they really care about. So this is what they really care about. And you'll hear Republicans campaign very hard on it. But the question is this. So, you know, once you get past that into the general election, and, you know, if one of them gets elected, are they really going to do it? You know, repealing the health care law turns out to be very difficult because, number one, as you know, you're taking insurance away from people. And then maybe or maybe not you come up with a replacement. But, you know, replacements are difficult. There's a reason this is hard. It takes so long is that, you know, health care is complicated. And any attempt to change health care policy, there are going to be some good parts and there are going to be some bad parts. And you're going to have to defend those bad parts even as you trumpet the good parts. And Republicans have not had to do that yet because they've not really put out a real serious proposal that's gotten a lot of scrutiny. If they go there, they will. And, you know, they'll be able to say, look, if you adopt our plan, A, B, and C will happen. Hooray. But then it'll quickly be pointed out that, by the way, D, E, and F will also happen. Those might not be so popular. And I suspect the smarter Republicans realize, number one, they don't want to go through that. Number two, at the end of the day, you know, the Affordable Care Act may be flawed. It is, you know, I don't think even its most passionate defenders would say it's ideal. I think many of its defenders would say it is far from ideal. It's got costs to go with its benefits, et cetera. But, you know, at the end of the day, you look at the pluses and the minuses, it probably stacks up pretty well to anything the Republicans would bring up there. And I think the Republicans know that. And that's why I think they will talk about this a lot. It's great for organizing, getting your base out there. It's great for raising money from passionate conservatives, but it's not necessarily such a good way to win a general election, and it's certainly not a way to actually pass legislation.
Well, Jonathan Cohn, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I'm happy to be on the show.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Cohn, who's a senior national correspondent at the Huffington Post, who was formerly a senior editor at the New Republic and an executive editor of the American Prospect. He is the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. And joining us now is Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Millhiser.
It's good to be back. Thanks so much.
And it seems today that the Supreme Court comforted the afflicted and afflicted the comfortable, at least in the extent to which the afflicted are the poorest among us, who have about 10 million people have gotten health care for the first time, and their coverage has been rescued by the Supreme Court. So I guess you have to give the court credit where credit is due.
You know, I mean, the court certainly is doing its part to depress my book sales right now. You know, I'll say this. So here's the thing. This lawsuit was the weakest case that has ever reached the Supreme Court in my memory. You know, the theory behind this lawsuit was that you could take one line of the Affordable Care Act, read it completely out of context, even though there's all of this other language in the law which contradicts the plaintiff's argument and which makes clear that that one line shouldn't be read the way the plaintiff said it should be read. And then based on this process of not reading the whole law, just reading one sentence, cause the law to do something ridiculous that no one intended it to do, and that leads to millions of people losing their care and thousands of people dying every year. So, like, this was an extraordinarily weak case. And what I think it came down to at the end of the day was this. You know, there are five justices on the Supreme Court who are very, very conservative. But they have to decide whether they're going to be an ideological judge or whether they're going to be a partisan judge. You know, what I mean by that is they have to decide whether they believe in some theory of the law, and it's a coherent theory of the law, and it often leads to conservative results, or whether they're just there to do the Republican Party's bidding. And there's a real difference between those two. You know, one of them calls upon them to engage in a certain type of intellectual honesty. And at least two of the conservatives on the court said, you know what, like, I may not think that this is a great law, but my job is not to do the Republican Party's bidding. My job is to be a judge. And, you know, so good for them. We got, you know, a much better decision than we could have gotten from the court today.
Well, the dissenters, led by Scalia, who read the dissent, and along with Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, Scalia basically argued that it's not the court's job to make up for the sloppy drafting of a law by Congress. So he's really making it clear there. If you have a clerical error, a typo, or one sentence that's ambiguous, as is the case here, you don't balance it against the thousands of other pages that show the clear intent of the law. You just kill it because you don't like it. You know, we're not going to fix up typos. I mean, that seems like the most narrow, vindictive reading imaginable.
Well, and more than that, I mean, well, first of all, this wasn't a typo. You know, this was a single sentence that if you just read it without any of the words around it, it seems to say one thing. But when you read it in context with everything else, it's clear that it means something else. You know, I learned in the first grade this skill of decoding sentences so you figure out what they mean in context rather than reading them in the isolation. I mean, this is an elementary reading skill that Scalia failed. And it's also an elementary reading school which Scalia has criticized other judges for failing. In Scalia's book, he says that the single greatest mistake that people often make in reading statutes is forgetting that you have to read them holistically, you have to read the words in context, rather than reading isolated provisions. So even Justice Scalia thinks that Justice Scalia's reading of the Affordable Care Act is wrong. And, you know, and again, it goes back to what I said earlier. You know, Scalia had to decide whether he believes in something coherent about the law or whether he's just a partisan. And, you know, unfortunately, he seems to have decided that he wants to be the latter.
Well, he's the champion of original intent. So it's so clear in the Affordable Care Act what the original intent of the act was.
Well, I mean, you know, Scalia likes to say that he believes in theories like textualism and originalism, but he has shown more ability to be flexible, you know, not just in this case. In the last Affordable Care Act case, you know, the reason why we have the individual mandate, remember the last case was a challenge to the individual mandate. The reason why we have it is because without the individual mandate, the whole law doesn't work. Without it, what happens is that people wait until they're sick to buy insurance. The insurance companies, the insurance pools fill up with people who are taking more money out of them than are paying into them. And the whole market eventually collapses because there isn't enough money going into the insurance pool to pay out the claims of the people who are taking out of it. The mandate stops that. And what Scalia has said, he said this in 2005, he said that when Congress has the power to regulate interstate commerce, it has every power needed to make that regulation effective. So if Scalia had applied his own rule in the first Obamacare case, he would have said, well, Congress is regulating the insurance market here. They have every power needed to make that effective, so that means they must have the power to enact this mandate. But, of course, Scalia didn't want to follow his own rule when the Affordable Care Act was involved. It's very unfortunate. I mean, you know, if he wants to have the power to make whatever discretionary calls he wants, he should run for Congress. But that's not his job. His job is to apply the law as a judge, and, you know, he just did not do that in this case.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. So given that it's Obamacare has survived its second near-death experience, I imagine the Republicans won't let go of it, particularly in this election year. But what was your impression of what the presidential candidates had to say today in terms of their criticism of the court's decision?
You know, Ahab's got to chase his white whale. You know, I mean, these guys, it just seems that no matter what happens, they think that, you know, killing Obamacare is that great big hope on the horizon that they've got to keep reaching for. But here's the thing. Like, what King v. Burwell offered politicians who opposed the Affordable Care Act is it gave them a way to launder what they wanted to do through someone else. It gave them an opportunity to try to get the Supreme Court to do their dirty work for them. And what the Supreme Court basically said to them today is you got to do it yourself. So, you know, if there's enough people who oppose the Affordable Care Act to control the Congress and control the White House, that they want to repeal it, let them be responsible for the 20 or 30 million people who lose their insurance. You know, let them live with the consequences in terms of, you know, threatened healthcare markets, in terms of hospitals that are suddenly inundated with people who can't afford care. You know, let that be on them. You know what today's decision does is it makes it clear who is responsible if we lose this thing that has been enacted, and it makes it clear who to blame if that happens.
So you don't think that the Supreme Court made a political decision not to? If they had struck it down, it would have outraged a huge percentage of the population, I think. Even with Republicans were polling against the idea of killing it because it seemed such a political act by the court. So they certainly have not handed the Democrats an issue here by upholding it. Otherwise, it would have, I think, handed them a huge election year issue, wouldn't it?
I mean, that's certainly possible. You know, I don't know. I doubt very much that Roberts and Kennedy went back to their chambers and made a kind of political calculation where they tried to figure out whether or not this is going to help Hillary Clinton in 2016. You know, I do think, though, that both of them care very much about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court and that they realized that this was such a ridiculous case. The legal arguments were so risible and the partisan implications of if they were to strike down these subsidies were so great. But I do think it probably weighed on them and made them think, you know what, like, this is not good for our legitimacy as the Supreme Court if we do something like this.
Well, Ian Millhiser, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about all the president's bankers.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidda-bidda-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bidda-bidda-rich, idle-diddle-diddle-diddle-man, I'd...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Naomi Prince, who's an author, journalist, and a senior fellow at Demos Think Tank. Her books include Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, and Black Tuesday. Before becoming an author and journalist, she worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group at Bear Stearns in London. Her latest book, just out in paperback, is All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Naomi Prinz.
Thank you very much.
And your excerpts from your book are available at The Huffington Post and at Tom Dispatch, and largely covering Jeb Bush's entrance and the Bush dynasty's connections to Wall Street. But in a broader context, it seems that in recent decades that the locus of power in the United States has shifted away from Washington to Wall Street. Obviously, there's always been power on Wall Street, but my understanding is throughout most of America's history, the power of Washington has always trumped the power of Wall Street. But has that relationship changed, do you think, in recent decades?
It certainly has. And as you say, there has been a lot more of a strengthening of power coming from Wall Street in the last year, since really the 80s through today, and that's accelerated. But that was also actually apparent in the turn of the last century, in the early 1900s through the 1929 crash. There was also a strengthening of Wall Street relative to Washington. And in between the years, between the 30s through the end of the 70s, it was a little bit more balanced. It wasn't that Wall Street had no part of Washington. It always has. Particularly in the last 130 years or so of American history, before which there was a lot of other bankers in different parts of the country also having influence with presidents. But it's just become much stronger in the recent decades because of two reasons. One is because Wall Street in general has become much less regulated, and the larger companies that control Wall Street are more concentrated in terms of the power and capital that they can influence and the individuals that do so. And also because there's been a lot of appointments of Wall Street CEOs into one of the most important positions in Washington, which is the Treasury Secretary position with respect to money, and of course many others as well. So there's just been a lot more going back and forth between Washington and Wall Street more recently. There's been much more money required to get people elected in the last decades as well. So that's also come into play. Wall Street has the money and the influence and also is able to, use it as it sees fit. But that said, presidents want it. This is a two-way street. This is not an imposition. This is an embrace.
Well, given that we're in the presidential season and that Jeb Bush is considered by many to be the Republican front runner, there is a clear dynastic history, is there not, with the Bush family, not just in American politics, but also on Wall Street, going back to Jeb Bush's grandfather?
Yeah, no, that's right. His great-grandfather, George H.W. Bush, ran an investment bank in New York on Wall Street named after him, which was eventually taken over by Merrill Lynch, which was a very powerful brokerage, and it still is, but in a component now of Bank of America, which wound up acquiring Merrill Lynch in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, not least because of some of those legacy Bush ties. And so there's really been over 100 and something years of development throughout the larger Wall Street, or some of the largest Wall Street banks, into a couple of the big six banks today that tie into different periods and different generations of the Bush family. So George Bush Sr., the first President Bush, was very closely associated with a former CEO of Merrill Lynch, Don Regan, who was the Treasury Secretary of Ronald Reagan, but because of the relationship with Bush. Again, that's the Merrill connection that goes back and forth through the century. Of course, George W. Bush selected as his Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, who was the chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs, which is another company that intertwines itself actually both with the Bush family as well as the Clintons, and they kind of play both sides. But Hank Paulson in particular, a Republican, was a Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush, and is actually came out supporting Jeb Bush before Jeb Bush publicly announced his candidacy. Hank Paulson endorsed him in April, so before the recent time. So there's all sorts of periods and individuals throughout over a century of Bush's and Wall Street leaders.
And again, I'm speaking with Naomi Prince, who's an author, journalist, and a senior fellow at Demos Think Tank. Her books include Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, and Black Tuesday. Before becoming an author and journalist, she worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group at Bear Stearns in London. Her latest book, just out in paperback, is All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. And the excerpt from the book is available at the Huffington Post and at Tom Dispatch. And the excerpt is largely about Jeb Bush and his family ties, which is what we're concentrating on here today. Now, Jeb Bush, of course, not surprisingly, because of the family Wall Street connections, has been showered with money. But he's certainly not catching on, at least at this point. But does that matter, do you think? I mean, can money really propel somebody in our money-driven system? One would think so. You know, you could run a ham sandwich for president, I guess.
I don't see Jeb Bush not winning the nomination. So, in other words, I see him winning the nomination because of the combination of the money behind him, as well as those legacy influences and power relationships and associations that the Bush family has had and has offered to a lot of the people with the most money throughout Wall Street and a lot of the other places in the corporate community. Jeb Bush, in a poll that the Wall Street Journal did, for example, back in December, so again, 6 months before he officially announced his candidacy, and this is how politics works. Things happen way behind the scenes, and later on the public hears about it. This is not different, but 73% of the CEOs, the most rich CEOs in the country when polled by the Wall Street Journal, said that they would want Jeb Bush to be the Republican candidate. The question wasn't about Republican candidate, not president, but that was kind of the implication. But 73%, so this was before his official nomination, and part of that's because they were already putting together money for him. And in the beginning of this year, and these things were reported but just not covered because the media was sort of off on talking about Rubio and Scott Walker and all these other people. But the reality is, from a money standpoint, and the meetings and the sort of rich $100,000 per head elite gatherings that were already going on in February and March, these were all about Jeb Bush. So unless something happens very differently, the people with the most money, they may split a little bit of it here or there to hedge their bets. But there are, you know, there's three generations here of Bushes, two which were president and one which wants to be. And that comes with a lot of family connections and power and favors and friendships and associations that do combine to get money behind a candidate and also support behind a candidate.
So obviously, with a couple of errant billionaires backing any of the other candidates, they can stay in a lot longer. The landscape has changed because of Citizens United. Means that if a Sheldon Adelson likes you, no matter what your chances are, you can stay in for a long time, right?
No, that's very true. And the whole super PAC mentality that we have, which was kind of reinforced by Citizens United and started in 2010, this is something where these individuals can throw out millions and millions of dollars. So Adelson has thrown in $93 million to Republican campaigns over the years. So he's definitely at the top of this list, and that's not your typical one-person contribution cap. I mean, this is a significant amount of money. Of course, it's coming from Democrats as well as Republicans, but coming from a component of billionaires in this country that have things to say and have money behind them and want that money to work for them. And that's where the whole super PAC mentality has come into play, is that most of the money, most of the big influential money, we should look at money as kind of two different things. There's the money that comes from individual donors and sort of corporate donations, which are larger than individual donors. But the super PAC money, the billionaire money, comes with a lot more ties to it in terms of the policy decisions that these people ultimately want made. And some of the super PACs, the 501(c), which is a branch of super PAC, doesn't even disclose or require the disclosure of any individual donor's name and information. So those kinds of PACs can effectively amass funds without having to ever, at this point in time, given our current legislation, ever disclose who gave what. They can just go in total or not. There's actually no need for any disclosure, even of totals. So all of that outside donor money, outside of the main parameters of campaign contributions, which themselves are kind of a joke, really is another large, large pool of very influential money, not just money, but influential money that comes into play in these campaigns and in the election and when someone's in office.
Well, what's relevant to my mind in terms of who's the steward of the economy as a president is, you know, your essential attitude. And we already saw that from the last Republican presidential offering of Mitt Romney, the kind of arrogance of that kind of vulture capitalist that he was. Well, it was a sort of insular arrogance. I don't think he was a nasty man. I think he was a fine, upstanding, good Mormon, but he just seemed to be all about making money, and whatever the morality was, that was a sort of secondary issue. And in the case of Jeb Bush, I mean, some of the sleazy connections he's had were exposed in recent New York Times articles, but this fellow down in Florida that he served on the board of was this massive fraudster who took down all kinds of people, a lot of professional sports players put up their life savings and were just completely fleeced. And there was no question about who this guy was and why Bush was on the, Governor Bush, Jeb Bush was on the board of directors, was exactly as a magnet, as a lure to bring money in, which he succeeded in doing. He got paid, eventually gave the money back to charity, which is what's happening to a lot of these people who've taken money from these right-wing white supremacists of late. They're giving back the money, but they took it in the first place. And we also know, of course, that Jeb's younger brother, Neil Bush, was a beneficiary of the savings and loan scam. That doesn't necessarily implicate him, but it sort of perhaps indicates a kind of attitude to money that the family has, since they are, in effect, a sort of an American aristocracy.
Yeah, I think not just to have any political family. I would say the same thing of the Clintons. The Bushes just have been doing it longer and have been in power, again, two presidents and other aspects longer. And there is a mentality of money being more important than attention to, say, details about fraud. Now, it isn't to say Jeb Bush committed the fraud, but yes, he was on a board overseeing what fraud, you know, fraud that was committed. And so that shows a kind of lack of either attention to detail or just a sort of hand-waving of, individuals who have money, who have power, somehow being in this more elite club and therefore being beyond reproach until something absolutely illegal and impossible to ignore comes out. And we've certainly seen that with the different aspects of Bush family. You know, you mentioned Neil Bush back in the savings and loan. There was obviously a lot that went on back then, and a lot of the investigations and documents surrounding his dealings with the SNLs were actually redacted in the George Bush Senior Library. I mean, I was actually looking through a lot of them when I was writing the president's bankers, because I was looking at relationships between these dynasties and their bankers, and you can't even get the actual information there. So that was an example where whatever did happen was redacted in the public records for the purposes of what was dubbed national security reasons. So there's a lot of power plays that come into the works in these, with this family.
Well, everybody seems to think that the father was a decent guy, and there's some evidence that he was, but nevertheless, he, through his appointees like Richard Breeden at the SEC, they did everything they could to deregulate the Glass-Steagall Act, which was eventually done by President Clinton, Bush's successor.
Right.
But he also reappointed Wendi Graham, Phil Graham's wife, at the CTFC. And, of course, Phil Graham is notorious for pushing Wall Street deregulation. And she's largely responsible at the CTFC of creating this monster known as derivatives that have been described as financial equivalent of thermonuclear weapons by Warren Buffett. So is that their legacy?
That's a big part of it. Certainly the Glass-Steagall Act, which was created in 1933 to differentiate banks' deposits and loans from individuals' with their more risky activities, which had contributed to the crash in 1929 and the Great Depression. That's where the Glass-Steagall Act came into play, to separate those two components of banking, and that was in place for many, many decades. And it was under George Bush Sr. as the VP for Ronald Reagan that a task force was created in Washington to look at deregulating the financial industry. And a lot of what happened under him as vice president, later as, you know, in his 4 years as president, were moves towards deregulating aspects of the financial industry. It wasn't a full-on repeal of Glass-Steagall. That did not happen until Bill Clinton's presidency repealed it in 1999. But all the little build-ups, all the arguments that were going on in Washington to enable banks to get back their deposits and more risky endeavors into one place, into one house, into one company, little pieces of that were happening all along. And, of course, George Bush Sr., by reappointing Wendy Graham as head of the CFTC, that under her, many investment banks, including Goldman Sachs, were coming to her with requests that they be allowed to trade certain derivatives, commodity derivatives, under the CFTC and get waived for any kind of limitations on what they could trade. So whereas it used to be that you couldn't trade certain commodities on the exchange unless you were actually a user of them. So an oil company could trade right. oil futures, but a bank could not.
Right, and that's not
to the same extent, and that changed.
Right. Well, I was going to say that's the key thing, that changed, and now the public gets gouged at the pump and gouged at the kitchen table because the Wall Street can run up the price of basic staples like food and gasoline at their whims, and we see that every day. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Naomi, but let's rejoin you as this race continues, because this seems to be the real DNA of what's going on with American political dynasties.
Yes, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Naomi Prince, who's an author, journalist, and a senior fellow at the Demos. Her books include Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, and Black Tuesday. Before becoming an author and journalist, she worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group at Bear Stearns in London. Her latest book, just out in paperback, is All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts at ianmasters.com, where you can also scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.